Prestige Jayco pre-game interview.
1989, the grand final, one of the greats, Hawthorn and Geelong. The Cats were on the wrong end of it, but it is clearly regarded as a classic. Go back and watch it for some of the incredible feats of not only skill, but also of bravery of the players. And a man has dug deep who's pretty good at this sort of stuff. He's pretty good at talking. He's pretty good at writing.
He loves it, this man.
And we love to have him on K-Rock Footy. Tony Wilson's been good enough to join us. G'day, Tony.
G'day, fellas. I'll tell you where I'd love to be. I'd be love to be there with you live watching this. Do I miss it?
Yeah.
Yep, we're lucky.
We've missed it. Tom King, Darren Berry, Mark Neild and Ben Casanilia with you, Tony. Firstly, the game provided us with something special at 31 years on. We still rave about as being one of the great grand finals. But for you, where did the impetus come to go and dig a little bit deeper into the game and write a book about it?
Well, it was a request, actually, from the publisher by the name of Jeff Slattery, who is a Hawthorn supporter, perhaps not surprisingly, but he ran footy media, and a lot of footy books have been produced by Slats over the years, and he gave me the tap on the shoulder and said, how would you like to go and visit your heroes again and ask them about this extraordinary day, and in the case of Geelong, meet some people that I'd never met before and get around and get the story, I guess, of what is such an iconic game in the history of our sport.
40 players played that day. Unfortunately, Alan Jeans is no longer with us as coach of the Hawks, but Malcolm Blight is, and I believe you had an audience with Blighty, which for anybody is a wonderful occasion.
So I was setting it all up, and I was about to do a distance interview of the modern style, and then a mate said to me, why don't you just get the plane ticket? It's $400 a turn, and Blighty will be talking to you in his living room. And I did that, and it's just the greatest decision I made. He gave me an hour and 40 minutes, and he basically ranged on everything from going to see, we used to do match reviews with Barass at Channel 7. Barass used to take the North Melbourne blokes to the Channel 7 studios to watch the game of the previous week. And Blighty was telling me that that kind of created his love for the analytics of footy. And so Blighty took me all the way back to the 70s and then becoming coach at Geelong and then the nights, the long nights, sipping port and dragging on his menthol cigarettes as he analysed games and wrote notes to the players. And it was just this feel of the 80s, of a one-man show and an enormous charisma, which we still see with Blighty when he speaks. But the Geelong players that were caught in it in 1989. It gets a little complicated because later on, Blighty's a different personality and a tough personality, and so some people he rubbed the wrong way. But in 89, there was none of that. It was a very harmonious Geelong team, and everyone, even people like Darren Flanagan, who said that there were some chinks that emerged later on in the Blight players' relationship, it was a very harmonious and very happy Geelong unit as they just flogged sides in 1989.
Tony, Darren Berry, great to speak with you again. I'm intrigued, Tony, I know Mark Yates was one of the people you spoke with, and we all very much know what happened at the start of that 89 grand final. How was it catching up with Mark Yates, and what can you tell our listeners?
A lot of fun. He works down at Geelong Grammar. He's the compliance officer or something down there, and he is a very funny man, and he told me the story of how it all started, in terms of the hit on Dermot. He was himself taken out in the round six clash. Dermot just with his eyes. Well, he kind of looked like he was looking at the ball, but he absolutely knew he was going to drive his knee into Yates' crotch, and he ruptured a testicle. And as Yates always says, it's very hard. He was having a shot at goal at the end of the game. It's very hard to get your leg around a swollen testicle. And he missed an opportunity to keep Geelong in the game, and so that's where it started, and Blight had the idea that Dermot was going to come for Couch. When Couch won the Brownlow, Blight says that Dermot was going to come for Couch, and everyone knew where Couch stood. He stood behind the ruckman. Couch wouldn't see Dermot coming, and he said he was absolutely paranoid about it, and he knew that Yates had had that incident with Dermot, and he went up to Yates on the Friday before the game and said,
how would you like this?
3 minutes you've got. And Yates said, why would I need 3 minutes? And the rest is history. And just to hear, it was so calculated. They marked an X on the ground, the shortest distance to get to him, and a real sort of a plot, really. And and Michael Schultz stood on the wrong side of them. He stood, I don't know how good Michael is at listening in meetings, but he stood on the way so that he was shielding Yates from Dermot. And so Yates had to kind of shift Schultz with his eyes and say, get on the other side. And what an athlete Yates was. He could run an 11-second 100 in as a schoolboy. And he'd only slowed down a little bit by, you know, getting towards 30 at this point. But he covered the distance in an incredible time. And the hit is just one of the things of great grand final folklore.
Yep. Did he say anything, Tony, about, I mean, obviously he's cleaned up Dermot, we know the damage he caused and et cetera, et cetera. Did it take the wind out of him at all? Like, was he injured in it or not?
No, he just got
all
him.
Clear.
Just a sweet contact. Got up straight away. He gave him, he told me, I said, how does that feel, you weak expletive? That's how he
yes.
said it originally. And I checked that expletive with him, and yeah, it was the full level of expletive he went with. And Dermot, some people wonder whether Dermot was hit a second time. They were very adamant, both of them, that there was no second hit. It kind of looks on the footage like there might be about to be, but there wasn't. Dermot went to get up and then just realised wind was out of him and he collapsed, yeah.
1989 is the book, The Greatest Grand Final, and we're lucky enough to be talking with Tony Wilson. He's Ben Castagnoli on K-Rock Footy.
Tony, so many stories out of the game. What was one that, you know, in doing the book that maybe sort of took you by surprise or something that you didn't know or something that the listeners would have absolutely no idea about that game?
Well, this one really shocked me. So, obviously, the Ablett show was in full swing and he gave Scotty McGuinness a fair bath over a quarter and a half. Well, Scotty did okay in the first quarter, but Ablett, in 12 minutes, just picked three goals and played. You know, he just looked like he was going to dominate McGuinness, and you sort of wondered whether McGuinness was up to that, and why wouldn't we have started, I was in the Hawthorn under-19s at the time, but why wouldn't Hawthorn have started Langford, the best defender, on Ablett? And what I found out was that on the preliminary final day, Hawthorn are going straight through to the grand final from the second semi, so they've got that weekend off. Geelong are playing Essendon at Waverley. They have the training session on the Saturday morning, Hawthorn do, in order to sort of stay fit. And then Chris Langford's decided he's had a plan to go down to Euroa to visit his brother-in-law. And Yabby Jeans at the end of training says, hey, grab your tickets from Hookie. We're meeting at 2 o'clock to watch the game at Waverley, Essendon Geelong. And Langford's having a pretty hard time of it in terms of combining his pretty full-on corporate job and footy. He goes, you know what, I'm going to still go to Euroa. I'm not going to go to that. So he doesn't go. He drives down the highway to Euroa and has the weekend away. Pre-email, pre-mobile phones. As you remember, you might know, Abbott plays an even better game the week before. I think he kicks something like 8-5 and has 25 possessions or something. And Jeans taps John Hook and says, where's Langers? I want to have a chat to him about how to play him. And he goes, they have to tell Jeans that Langford hasn't turned up to the watching of the game. And so just fury on the answering machine for Langford when he gets back to Melbourne on Sunday night and gets run through again on the Monday from Jeans and says, you know, you've let us down. And then on the Thursday when the meeting happens, they pick McGuinness on Ablett. And Langford goes up after the game, after the meeting, and says, yeah, why haven't I got Ablett? I want Ablett. And Yabby said to him, we wanted to talk to you about Ablett on Saturday. You weren't there. You chose Euroa. So Scotty gets the first crack at it. And, you know, I think, honestly, and I asked a few of the players this, would he have changed his decision on a disciplinary level? And most of them say that's not true. He was probably just having another crack at Langford to make him sort of motivate him for the contest. But I had no idea about that Langford missed a compulsory game that they were meant to attend and that there was that little bit of friction going between, you know, Hawthorn's fullback of the century and the great Alan Jeans.
The great folklore story, which is probably 100% incorrect, is that Gary Ablett said to Scott McGuinness just before they bounced the ball that, I thought you were coached by the master coach. He's made a big mistake here. And he kicked the first goal on him inside 20 seconds. Did you attempt, Tony, to speak to Gary Ablett?
Oh, I had a few goes. I spoke to a few Geelong players and I didn't really have a number for him. And I was working on a pretty tight deadline And in terms of getting him, I now know how I could have got him. I know a bloke who's pretty good friends, the Wilkins family, I believe, are very close to Gary. And I know Paul Wilkins is a mate of mine. And so I've now got this in that I have now. But I was writing the book, I thought it was going to be a struggle. It had been, a fair bit of turmoil over the last couple of years for Gary. And as the story was emerging, it was actually amazing how people were talking about him, that there was this sort of mythical figure, and the story was being built by all the people around him. And I wondered even, whether Gary would add that much. He would have. I wish I had spoken to him, but I didn't get him. I haven't got an interview with him.
Yeah, that maybe could be the sequel, Tony. Gazza gets his tent actually, and the Cats get up.
I'm sure a lot of Geelong people buying the book asking whether I've changed the ending for them. But no, it's I think as Mark would know, it was a day of heartbreak for the Cats, on three levels, under-19s, reserves and senior. Summer. You were playing that day, Mark.
I was in the early time slot. It wasn't a great day for the club, although it was fantastic to have what was back then a different type of club that had the three teams, one the 19 and unders and then the reserves and the seniors. And unfortunately, all three of us got done by, I think the seniors was the biggest margin, and that was 6 points.
I know, it's unbelievable. Yeah. Rezzy's coughed up a 30-point lead or something. It was brutal.
It was. I think the reserves, from memory, I think they might have Fitzroy, was that right? And then Doc Wilden and his mate. Dean Lupson. I think they had. Yeah, they just thought they were at the circus for a bit and got really carried away for about 10 or 15 minutes. And yes, that was interesting. But that was a fascinating year, I think, for the whole of the Geelong City. You mentioned before, and it was interesting to hear you say, guys like Darren Flanagan talk about the differences in 89 and then some things that happened after. But, yeah, that's what it was like. The whole season was just so much fun. And, everyone, you just want to get to training so early. You'd want to get to the game so early. You couldn't wait for the next Saturday afternoon to come around. I can remember some stories. Blighty used to share with us later how scarce the injury room was. Even if there were guys that were sore, they wouldn't go anywhere near the trainers, anywhere near the medical staff, just for fear that they might miss. That's how the good form that everyone was in. But it was certainly, look, that would have been great, the experience you had. There were certainly a number of characters. I know Ben asked before, Willow, about some stories perhaps that we wouldn't have known. Was there anyone, I know you said you hadn't met many of the Geelong players, was there anyone that you really didn't know anything about and they popped up and you thought, he's a different bloke or a funny bloke or he had a lot to do in the group that you were surprised about?
Oh, I love talking to Darren. I love talking to Darren Flanagan, very intelligent and philosophical guy. And his partner in owning the Valley Inn Hotel that year was a bloke by the name of Bruce Linder.
The press. Come on. I know, actually, I know what Bruce gets up to these days. He's he's over in Adelaide. He loves a drop of red, Bruce. He's quite... tell us about the Prez.
So I went to his place in Unley in Adelaide, and it looked like he was going pretty well. He had a pretty nice place.
He looks... some things haven't changed, Willow.
And he just told me fantastic stories. He told me about turning up at the first night of pre-season, and Blighty asked if anyone couldn't do the 5x2,000 metre times trials.
That's a nightmare, that stuff.
And Bruce said, "Oh, look, I'm actually feeling a little jet lagged. I'm just back from San Fran," and all the players remember that he said San Fran and not San Francisco. And Blighty basically just moved him into the reserves group, and he played his first game in round 7, I think, in 1989. But he was just fantastic to talk about. He told me that there was a night where you got beaten by Fitzroy, I think, by a point, and you coughed up a 5 or 6 goal lead at 3/4 time at Princess Park and lost. It was one of your few losses for the year, and there was this, everyone was in a panic because Blighty dressed down the whole club. He got all the trainers in, your admin in, he got the players in and said, what sort of a club are you? You've been a joke for years. You continue to be a joke. You've just copped up five. Bring your mouth guards on Monday, and then they arrive. They arrive at training and in a panic. It's going to be hard tonight. And then look up and they just don't get changed. And Blighty breezes in and says, "Right, that's done. I understand two of you blokes have bought a pub, Linda and Flanagan.
Yes, that's right.
Get down there and christen it." And so I'm putting $200 on the bar. You've got to stay for 2 hours at least. You don't have to drink, but you're welcome to if you want. And Flanagan and Linda kind of look at each other and go, "Shit, we really haven't put on enough staff." And so it's this sort of that. And they, a lot of players refer to that, that there was this unpredictability about Malcolm in terms of the moods. And you know, I think there was one guy, Andrew Rogers.
Yeah,
Andrew
we
Rogers.
Called him Buck. Yep, number 20.
Yeah, Buck Rogers had Malcolm at Woodville and had said, you know, he's called the Wonder Coach for a reason. You wonder what he's going to do next. And that was his line. And certainly that night at the pub kind of gave credence to that. You know, it was just sort of, yeah. And Malcolm himself, he was wonderful in terms of talking about his beliefs in how footy should be played and coached. And he said, "Oh, look, Monday, winning begins on Monday is one of my sayings, you know. So whatever happens on the weekend, my job as the coach is to create a mood and an atmosphere on a Monday that makes us ready to win the next week." And he said, "Oh, I used to do lots of weird things on Mondays. We'd have trivia nights and we'd have Twister, and you know, basically it was this sort of thing of surprise them on Monday, give them something different to do, set the mood for the week, and if something bad's gone on the weekend, like a bad loss to Fitzroy, you know, go to the pub and team build and create a different mood." And he was a master at that.
Look, he was. I suppose my final word on that would be, yeah, what you've said there, I look forward to having a read, because it's very much the stuff that I remember. And just the final word on Blighty, yeah, you're exactly right. Whatever happened on Saturday, good, bad or indifferent, he would get it out of his system immediately following the game. The next time he saw the player group, we were always amazed. He had already worked out how, no matter who we were playing and what the result of the previous week was, how we were going to win in 5 days' time. He was a marvel at it.
Yeah, absolutely. Tony, we really appreciate your time. I reckon we could talk all night, but we're not too far away from bounce. You're about half an hour between the Cats and the Hawks down here at GMHBA Stadium. There's a podcast coming, I believe, Tony?
Yeah, so if you have a look at Speak Ola is my podcast, and I put up one about Pay the Price. But yeah, I'm going to do a 1989 Grand Final podcast as well with the interviews.
All right. Father's Day is not far away, just under 3 months. Head to or email tony@tonywilson.com.au. $35, signed copy of the book. We've put the details up on social media too, Tony. We really appreciate your time. Great effort with the book, and look forward to hopefully maybe one day there being a sequel where the results changed and Ablett does kick his 10th and there's a draw and we play the following week.
Well, get the club to commission me to 797. I'm willing.
We'll have a chat. Tony, really appreciate your time. Thanks for joining us.
See you later.
Tony Wilson joining us there, the author of 1989. You can email him, tony@tonywilson.com.au. $35 signed copy. He'll get it out to you. That would be the ideal Father's Day present. Some inside stories on 1989.
Prestige Jayco pre-game interview.